everybody. Welcome to lecture 11, which is our last lecture of GRG 1, preparing you for the delights of GRG 2, starting next semester. So we are, astonishingly for me, in very good time. So we've made excellent progress, and so I think we might, we're not under time pressure this week. So we might even finish early. Where I got to last time was I was talking about, and I hope justifying, the idea of the physical statement of Einstein's equations relating the Einstein tensor, which is composed of the Ricci tensor and the coverage tensor and the metric, with and equating that, or making that proportional to the energy momentum tensor, which characterizes the distribution of energy momentum in a particular volume. That sounds rather abstract. What it means is if you have a single mass in the center of the universe, that is characterized by an appropriate energy momentum tensor. If you have an extended object, or if you have a universe full of a certain distribution of energy momentum, that's characterized by the energy momentum tensor, and Einstein's equation tells you what the consequent distribution shape of space-time is. And that is basically it, as far as the equations go. However, one of the first, one of the solutions to this was, which you will learn about in GRG 2, I think, or you, which you've also learned about in the cosmology lectures you've had, I'm sure, is the notion of the expanding universe. There's a solution to Einstein's equations which consists of a universe which is expanding. And this was felt at that time in the 30s, I think, to be obviously unphysical, obviously unreasonable. That can't be that can't be an answer. So it was thought to be an illegitimate solution. And that was therefore, you know, fair enough, that's fine, it produced unphysical solutions. So Einstein deduced that his work was not done at this point, and he added another term to this. Which I will write down in that case, which was G mu nu plus lambda G mu nu equals kappa T mu nu, where lambda is autofocus off, where lambda is just a scalar multiplying the metric. And he said, okay, that's clearly what I should have said first time, and when you add that term, one of the whole universe solution, you can get a static whole universe solution out of it. And it was only later, when the Hubble-Lemaître expansion was discovered, and it became clear as a matter of observation that the universe was in fact expanding, that he referred to this as his greatest blunder. That he had wimped out effectively by believing experiment too experiment too much and not going with the original plan of just sticking with the original version with lambda equals zero. Now, in a further twist, as you possibly are aware, much later on, starting in the 2000s, it became clear from supernova observations that the aiming to discover whether the universe was on the larger scales, positively, negatively, curved, or flat, it became clear that the most distant supernovae were receding from us, fair enough, but at an increasing rate. So the universe seemed to be inflating, being driven by some sort of external pressure term. And that was the motivation in the 2000s for bringing this version of Einstein's equation back, get a non-zero cosmological constant, a non-zero value of lambda, now referred to as the cosmological constant, which has the effect, with suitably chosen values of lambda, of adding a negative pressure to what is effectively a negative pressure to the universe, which means the universe ends up expanding at a slightly accelerating rate. That's all very far in the future. The point of saying this is to say what I said last time, really, that this is a guess, which is corroborated by observation. Einstein thought better of it, then changed his mind again, and we'll soon change our mind again to bring that term back. But the point is that this is these steps here of this version or that version or this version or that version are, by this point, not mathematically, but physically and observationally and astronomically motivated. And there's a lot more one could say there about where does this term come from, quantum gravity or something like that. There are a variety of rabbit holes we could dive down at this point, but we shall forbear. Okay. I'll move fairly swiftly on, unless there are any questions about that. No. Okay. What I said the last time was this all leads us to the point where space tells, and this is a formulation attributable to, I think it's Wheeler, John Wheeler, space tells matter how to move, and matter tells space how to curve. You may well have seen that slogan before, but now you have the essentially all of the mathematical background to understand what's actually going on in that slogan, what that slogan is actually summarising. And to some extent at this point, the job of GRG1 is done. The job of GRG1 is to give you the mathematical technology that will allow you to go on and make sense of GRG2. Because GRG2, next term, Dr. Veach is taking over this year, is essentially about solutions to Einstein's equation, the Schwarzschild solution, the Friedman-Lemaître-Robertson-Walker solution, gravitational waves, and so on and so on, and the ways you can do that. So that's the payoff. But I can't take you to the threshold of that and not give you any solutions at all. So we're going to look at one solution of Einstein's equation in outline just now. The pretty picture to show you what an orbit in our space-time is supposed to look like. I said that. Okay, so you will recall that somewhere, I think in part one, I mentioned the idea of natural units in which the speed of light is equal to one, which is essentially us deciding to use the light meter as our source, as our unit of time, our convenient unit of time, in units of which light moves at 1 meter per light meter, or one. It's not dimensionless, it's merely unitless. People who are worrying about GR tend to work in a set of units in which G, big G, is equal to one. And that means that the, we can take C squared equal to zero, equal to one or not, but the big G had the value 7.2 × 10⁻²⁸ meters per kilogram, which, just like C being equal to one is a conversion between seconds and meters, this is a conversion between kilograms and meters. So that masses in these units are measured in meters, which makes sense which seems weird, but makes sense when you discover the Schwarzschild solution, discover that the Schwarzschild solution has in it a parameter which has the dimensions of meters, which is essentially the size of the event horizon of a collapsed object. So jumping ahead a bit, in the Schwarzschild solution, there is a size parameter inside which the only time-like geodesics are inwards. In other words, even light cannot escape. There's no time. There's no not even a null path to greater radius inside the radius. In other words, it's a black hole. So what the Schwarzschild solution tells you is that there are such things as black holes which have a radius which is proportional to G and M. In which context it makes sense that there is a natural correspondence between mass and the gravitational radius of that mass. So the mass of the Sun, for example, is 3 kilometers. That being the size of the black hole into the size which, if you compress the Sun inside, would make a black hole. And you can divert yourself by working out what your own gravitational radius is, and it's a very small number. It'll be 10 to the minus 28 times whatever your weight is in kilograms, in meters. And as a curiosity there, what this also, a curiosity here is that even in classical gravitational physics, the thing that controls the orbit, well, Newton's gravitational potential is Gm over R, as you will doubtless recall. And it's Gm that controls the orbits, the behavior of particles in the solar system, and not G or M separately. They never appear separately. And what that means is that it's relatively easy to find what Gm is, and if you're doing classical mechanics of the in the solar system, the parameter of interest is Gm. And it's quite easy to determine that from looking at the ephemerides of planets going around the sun, and you can estimate Gm to, I think, 1 part in 10 to the 10. It's extremely accurate, to an accuracy where general relativistic corrections matter. But the only way you can find what G is using terrestrial experiments, such as looking at plumb bobs next to mountains and so on, as you will be aware. But you can only do that to about 1 part in 10 to the 5. And the way you find what the mass of the sun is by finding what Gm is and dividing it by G. So the mass of the sun in kilograms is obtained by Gm over G and has the error of G, which is 10 to the minus 5, 10 to, 1, well, 1 in 10 to the 5. But the error, the uncertainty of the sun's mass in meters is essentially the error of the sun's of the gravitational power of Gm. So the mass of the sun in meters is known to about 10 to the minus 10, 1 in 10 to the 10, and in kilograms only to about 10, 1 in 10 to the 5. So there's a nice inversion of what you might expect there. Sorry, that's all in a big parenthesis, really. Moving on. The point here is that we're now going to look at the solution of Einstein's equations in a particular approximation, namely the weak field approximation, the approximation of small masses, so a small central mass, something planet-sized or star-sized, something like that. So just it's isolated in the universe. Or equivalently, the approximation where you're looking at the solution for a mass, but you're quite far away from the mass, so the masses, so second-order terms disappear. And the way we do that, and I'm going to go through this in outline rather than in line-by-line detail, is we approximate the metric by the Minkowski metric, which is minus plus 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 on the diagonal, plus a perturbation. And the point here that this is a perturbation, H is small in the sense that the magnitude of all the values of H is much less than 1. So H squared is ignorable. Now that's a matrix equation and not a tensor equation. But it turns out that for reasons which we could expand on, but might expand on if we have more time at the end, this can be treated as if H were a tensor. And what we can then do is re-express, the point I want to make here are that what you're doing here is essentially changing into coordinates in which H can be regarded as a tensor. Now, and there's a couple of ways of thinking of that. One is that you're making a particular coordinate transformation which is constrained by the constraint that this be small, or you can regard this, and this is quite a productive way of thinking about it. You can regard this as being, as it asking about the behavior of a tensor H in a Minkowski background, as fluctuations on a Minkowski background. The point is that using that, you can then calculate what expressions for the connection for the Riemann tensor in terms of H as opposed to G, and then express Einstein's equations, which are of course obtained from the Riemann tensor and its contractions, in terms of H. And because you then, at that point, are dealing with something which is small, where second-order terms can be neglected, that becomes easier to solve. And the solution is, look at this just to get the terms right, where h, as a quasi-tensor, is diagonal h naught naught, h 1 1, h 2 2, h 3 3, where all of these are equal to the same phi, and plugging this back into the Minkowski metric, using the Minkowski metric again, that means that our solution is diagonal minus 1 plus 2 phi, 1 minus 2 phi, 1 minus 2 phi, 1 minus 2 phi, or with an interval of squared plus 1 minus, I'm checking here just to make sure I get the signs right. Where d sigma there is the is the spatial sector, and so that's so that's the metric in that low mass weak field approximation, and I've missed out a bit here, which is fiddly rather than hard. And Schutz, for example, does go through it step by step. It's not terrifically edifying, but it's sort of reassuring that it's actually quite a short calculation, roughly. Well, I think even there, part of what he says is, if you then go through this and work out what the components of R are in detail, it's several pages of algebra, but it's not hard algebra, if you like. It's just turning the handle. So that's all very nice. That looks rather pretty. Jumping ahead, because we have time and it's quite interesting, you will discover that when you discover the Schwarzschild solution next semester, you discover that this ends up being the exact solution for this same problem of a single central mass. You get an expression for the for the metric, which is equal to this to first order. So in this case, we have obtained this by demanding that, well, by building on the fact that h is small. We can recover this as the low mass limit of the Schwarzschild solution by depending on phi being small. At that hand, yes. A second.
What is phi's physical significance?
Good point. This ends up being remarkably enough, what comes out of this is that phi is just the numerically the same as Newton's gravitational potential. So Newton's gravitational potential pops out of this in exactly the place you'd expect, and it turns out that this radius is too the radius 2gm turns out to be this. Which is basically, you can see the two coming from there. That radius is the radius which I mentioned, which is the size where the Schwarzschild solution gets interesting and where the black hole appears. So the size of a black hole is directly linked to this GM parameter, which appears just as this potential factor inside the metric. So that's very nice. But what can we do with that? Well, we've done half the thing. We have worked out at this point that a solution for Einstein's equations. The next thing we have to do is work out how do things move in that space-time. And we can do that by using the geodesic equation. Right. So, the geodesic equation, we've seen versions of it. But if you look back, one of the versions, the sort of primal version of the geodesic equation is that one, which is the one saying that as you parallel transport the tangent to a geodesic along the geodesic, it stays tangent to the geodesic. So that's the mathematical version of walking in a straight line. And the path you draw out by walking in a straight line is a geodesic. That's not particularly convenient, but let's instead recall that we can talk about the full momentum of an object as just being the mass times the full velocity. In this case, we're taking the full velocity to be the full velocity along a geodesic. So this geodesic equation turns into an expression involving the momentum of an object. And then but that's the geometrical version of it. You will recall that the component version of that, get everything in the right place and choose the right indexes that I'm consistent with, is that involving the covariant derivative of the vector p. So that's just the component version of this, which is a scaling of the geodesic equation. So we're asking what is the field of p vectors or momentum vectors which satisfies this equation and thus which indicate the geodesics in the space time. And in this space-time comes in because this covariant derivative is picking up the way that the components change as you move around the space. So the curvature, if you like, is in the curvature of the space we're looking at here is in that covariant derivative. And now, so that's exact this far. Now, because we're interested in the weak field solution, we're going to take another weak field approximation, which is to say that things are going to be moving slowly. What that means is that for the momentum four vector of the geodesic we're interested in, the time component is going to be much larger than the spatial component. So things are going to be moving through time faster than they're moving through space. They are moving slowly, in other words. Okay. So, what this implies is, and again, keeping things neat, p alpha p mu comma alpha plus gamma mu alpha beta p alpha p beta equals zero. All I'm doing there is simply writing that out in a slightly longer version. But if the zero components of these vectors are much larger than the spatial components, then we can essentially discard all the spatial components in that sum. So the only terms that will survive in that sum are going to be the zero, zero terms. And similarly, the only term that survives in this sum here over alpha is the zero term, then given that the P is equal to gamma M one in MV, sorry. No, gamma M one. The momentum full vector is proportional to the gamma, the mass of the object being moving, plus this one vx, vy, vz vector here. That means that the at low speed, when gamma is small, gamma is one, the zero component is just m, so it's m dp mu by d tau that survives. So all we're doing here is this covariant derivative in this approximation. I should probably say. Okay, now what we can then do is go back to the metric here and do the things that were now, I hope, fairly well rehearsed at, calculating the Christoffel symbols corresponding to this metric. And we find most of them are zero, as is so often the case when there's a high degree of symmetry. And the ones that are not are gamma 0, 0, 0, which is equal to phi comma 0 plus terms of order phi squared, which remember is small, and gamma I 0, 0, which is comma G. Both terms involving phi, as before. Okay, and what, if we then look at this component by component, we find that, therefore, M dP naught by d tau, yeah, I can't write, plus gamma 0, 0, phi, comma 0, P naught squared, which is just M dP naught by d tau plus I'm expecting to see another term here, P naught squared. Oh yes, plus M squared. Yes, squared phi comma naught equals zero, or dp naught by d tau is equal to minus m d phi by d tau. And what that is saying is that the change in the energy of this particle is proportional to the change in time of the potential, and we given that there isn't more mass suddenly appearing here, that's going to be zero. In other words, that's saying the energy is conserved as the particle moves along the geodesic. So we've found one of the relevant descriptions of the motion. Now looking at the spatial one, and looking at this one here, what we then discovered there is that dpi by d tau is equal to minus m phi comma I, which is the a spatial derivative of the of this potential, which is just a funny way of writing the rate of change of momentum, the force, is equal to minus m grad phi, which you will recognize as the equations of motion in Newton's gravitational theory, that a particle moves in such a way that the rate of change of its momentum is directed along the gradient of the gravitational potential, which is very gratifying, because this means that the low energy approximation of Einstein's theory recovers the manifestly successful theory of gravity that Newton developed from starting from a completely different place. So I think I've missed these quick questions. Those are in the notes. So I think that's basically about it. And I think that's a remarkable thing. I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself, I seem to be more like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself now and then, finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me. There's a certain dejection to that, I think, on Newton's part. He knew that he had done great things and found beautiful, mathematically beautiful explanations of what had happened, but there was much more to find. It took 300 years to find something that was better, but as we've discovered, what he did is contained within a later theory. And that is essentially it. We're ahead of time. I've slightly spun out by talking about Schwarzschild solution and GRG2 and so on. But I think it's actually a first that I've managed to get to the end without galloping through the last lecture in something of a mild panic. But as we've got here, we've got all the technology, you've got one solution, and you have the Broadstone and Uplands of GRG2 to find all sorts of other solutions next semester. And so we might as well stop there, or we'll get questions. Questions. If everyone wants to run off, that's fine. If you want to turn this into an impromptu supervision session, or question session, question answer session, or chat session, then that's fine too. Have at it. A question over there.
When you say we restrict ourselves to the motion of a relativistic particle, mm-hmm. we have this. Where does this come from?
Okay, like, right. So the question there is this approximation. Why that? Do we have that approximation? It basically comes from this. So you may recall, you may not recall, that when you talk, when in special relativity, you talk about the relativistic velocity. It's a form of momentum, which includes let's talk about the momentum rather than the velocity. The form of momentum involves the spatial momentum and the time component of the form of momentum, which is the energy of the particle. And you discover that the low speed limit of that. Well, in the frame in which in other words, it's that. Does that look sort of familiar? Have you seen something like that before, or vaguely enough that you'll believe me that that's the case? Okay, right. So that's the case. And the low speed in the frame in which the particle is not moving, you discover, good heavens, that the zeroth component is gamma m, which doesn't go to zero as the speed goes to zero, the zero component energy is gamma m, or in physical units, gamma mt squared, or when v is zero, E equals mt squared. That's where E equals mt squared comes from. But in this case, the time component is always gamma m. But in the case where you're looking at particles which are moving only slowly, and by slowly meaning much less than the speed of light, then each of these spatial components, vx, vy, vz, will be much less than 1, much less than c. And so these, and that will be therefore true of the overall momentum component. So the spatial components will be small, smaller than the energy components, simply because the energy component is primarily the particle's mass. So in the case where essentially all of the particle's energy is in the form of its mass, as opposed to its mass and its kinetic energy, then we can solve this in that limit to get Newton's theory. So that's telling us that Newton's theory goes wrong when things move at relativistic speeds, which isn't terribly surprising. And what that means is things go wrong when things move at relativistic speeds, A, because they're moving rapidly, and B, because there is a component, there's an element of energy in the simply by virtue of the particle's motion, which gravitates. So the energy that's in a particle's motion, the energy momentum that's in a particle motion, it was in Einstein's theory, it's energy momentum that gravitates, not mass. And that is a thing which does not, so if something moves faster, then it gravitates more. And that's something that is completely alien to Newton's theory. That just cannot be there in Newton's theory. That's why, in a sense, this has to be the limit in which Newton's theory will pop out. The case where we're ignoring the gravitating influence of kinetic energy. That's the physical interpretation of that. So this is, as I mentioned, this links to the Schwarzschild solution in the sense that this metric here is derivable as the low phi limit of the Schwarzschild solution. The Schwarzschild solution is the exact solution to an approximate problem, in the sense that it is the solution to the approximation where the universe has one mass in it. And that's not actually true. There's more than one star in the universe. But in our environment, it's a very, very good approximation. And it's the Schwarzschild solution that is used for essentially all of the relativity corrections to things like GPS, to things like precise timing, to things like the deflection of radio waves by going near the star, the sun, and the Eddington Dyson observations of the deflections of the starlight as it comes past the sun in an eclipse, which you've heard of. Yes, the Eddington. Perhaps I didn't mention that. I didn't mention that, but. It might be that sort of normally comes later than the what I'm saying, but earlier than GRG2, because amongst the effects of this solution to GR, well, if you remember back in lecture one, beginning in part one, one of the things we discovered was the equivalence principle tells you that light must bend in a gravitational field. That the whole business of things falling down lift shafts, but we didn't calculate how much that deflection was. Now you can calculate it based on the gravitational redshift of our particle. So one of the other things we mentioned in part one was the idea that as our photon climbs through a gravitational field, its frequency changes. And to the extent that frequency is a proxy for a clock, a photon oscillation is a proxy for a clock, that is telling us that time moves differently at different gravitational potentials. And from that, you can deduce through a few steps, but not too many, that there will be a particular deflection of starlight as it comes past a gravitating body. You can work out what the deflection will be purely from that. And you can also use this solution, this approximate solution, this Wakefield solution of Einstein's equations, to work out what the deflection, what the geodesic of a photon is as it goes near a mass, whatever near counts as. And you discover it's deflected, of course. You know, it would be very, very bad if that didn't happen. So there's a deflection of light as it goes near a mass. And you can calculate what the angle of that deflection is. And you discover it's twice the angle that you got when you used only the gravitational redshift. Which, and so Einstein and Eddington got to the first answer first. I think Einstein got the I think it was 1913 or something, that he worked out how much the deflection would be based purely on the gravitational redshift. And that was the prediction for how much that deflection would be. And it was only after, in about 1916 or 17, I think, when this solution was available to work out what the deflection would be based on the field equations. And so there's going to be a deflection, or the prediction. And how do you find that deflection? You look at stars as the light from them moves near a massive body. Is there a convenient massive body in the neighbourhood? Yes, there is, the sun. Unfortunately, you can't see the stars in the daylight because the sun's very bright. So what you do is you wait for an eclipse. And conveniently, there was a total solar eclipse visible from some parts of the planet in 1919, so just after the First World War. And I could go on this story for quite a long time because it had all sorts of layers of interest. But the short version, the focusing on the physics version, is that it was a fairly clear prediction at this point of GR that there would be a deflection. And so there was an expedition mounted by Eddington, who was the head of the Cambridge Observatory, and Herbert Dyson? Frank Dyson, who was the director of the Greenwich Observatory. And they put together the equipment, you know, scattered because of the First World War, put together the equipment to make an expedition to Brazil and the... I don't want to say Cape Verde Islands. Anyway, somewhere in the southern Atlantic where they were going to see totality. And long observational story later, the three possible outcomes of that observation were no deflection, which is what, in a sense, the Newtonian theory would say. The what was called the Newtonian deflection, which was the one that Einstein and co. had produced based on purely gravitational redshift, and the full Einsteinian deflection, which was the one that obtained from this, which is twice the Newtonian one. And the bit of observational nightmare, things which were supposed to work didn't work, there was rain, in the field, literally, covered in mud, in the 10 minutes or whatever, during totality, but they did manage to exclude the no deflection case, and arguably and correctly exclude the Newtonian version, and thus confirmed by direct observation that the deflection was what Einstein's field equation said. And Einstein instantly became a worldwide celebrity and so on. And there's also footnotes to that story which are fascinating, which I might put together something and pass on to you because it's interesting. I can't remember where I started off with this. Yes, but the point is that's an approximate solution. But the Schwarzschild solution is the exact solution to the same problem, which can be approximated, and the Schwarzschild solution is a metric which can be approximated by this. Sorry, that was a very long answer to a question which I slightly lost track of, but are there more?
So the time, you have a mass.
Yeah.
We know that photons will be the gravitational well.
Yeah.
How?
Photons move. Yes. So, right. So the question is, why are photons deflected by this? And the answer to that is that this is the what we have here is the that's the equation we're solving. What is the geodesic traced out by a momentum four vector. Now, we motivated it here by describing the momentum of a massive particle. But I don't think we covered this here. You can also talk about the momentum of a photon. Even classically, you could talk about the momentum of a photon, how much or the momentum of an electric field. As an electric field interacts with matter, it will transmit momentum to it, in some cases, through the Lorentz force law and so on. And that you can talk about the momentum of a classical field. And if you think of the quantum mechanics, you will know that the photons have four vectors. They have energy and momentum. And so what we're solving here is the geodesic of the momentum four vector, so something irrespective of what is the momentum four vector of. So for a massive particle, it'll be the mass times the four velocity of that object. For a photon, that the four velocity doesn't really mean much, and the mass is zero, so we have a different definition of what the four momentum is. But it's still that we're solving. However, in this expression for the potential phi, the mass here is the mass of the central object. That's the mass of your star, or your planet, or whatever it is you're talking about. So does that sound evasive, or is that the does that cover? This minus sign here. Okay. I think that comes just because this is a rewrite of m dp I by d tau plus and I think we're just rearranging that equation. That's the geodesic. That's the space part of the geodesic equation, and so just rearranging that is where that minus sign appears. Is that about it? A question there. Okay. Okay, so we go back to here. H here in the tensor, because there's in a sense no reason why it should be. All we've done here is write down the components of the metric in a particular frame, being the components of the Minkowski metric, plus some other components. So this is just a matrix equation. So there's nothing. We write down that and not care, and not make any constraints about what H is. H could be as big as we like. We are, however, choosing. The point of doing this is that we want to say these are perturbations. So we want to say these are small. But that's not a tensor thing to say. You can't really talk about a tensor, in that context, a tensor being small. So we couldn't write G equals eta plus H and say H is small. Because that doesn't really mean, that's not a tensorish thing to say, if you like. There's a better way of expressing that. But we are saying, we're making this constraint as a matrix constraint. So it's true, this approximation is meaningful only in a particular frame. So that's basically it. This is a frame-dependent approximation. It's only in one frame, in the local inertial frame, that we can talk about these components being small. And it's then involves a bit of stepping back and think about it to discover that when you turn the handle, you can review this as a tensor on a flat background. So I think that the basic aha is that approximation, that those pair of things, is meaningful only in a small set of coordinate choices, namely those which are almost Minkowskian. And there's a dangerous bend section there, which I think was added after a very similar question one other year, which goes into a little more detail about that, which talks about what you're doing here is either talking about a tensor on a flat background, or you're talking about a gauge choice here. And if you've done a quantum field theory, as some of you will have done, if you've done classical electromagnetic theory and the notion of the Lorentz gauge, you will discover that there is the notion of gauge fixing, of making a gauge choice, essentially the exotic mathematical version of choosing the right coordinates. If you choose the right coordinates, then you can do all your calculations in a particular gauge where things are simple. And this is essentially, therefore, a gauge choice in those terms. And that is time up, I think. So I have the usual, second officer tomorrow, and I think we have a supervision a week on Friday. So I may see some of you then. Goodbye and enjoy.